Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 371, Loving Jewish Agitation. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And as you know, we wrapped up our series on spirituality last week, and we talked a bit about needing spiritual technologies that help us dissolve ourselves and experience being part of a larger organism. And while our conversation today is not really part of that spirituality series, I can't help but think that elements of today's conversation are a good representation of what it looks like when we see that connection between our sense of being connected to a larger organism and feeling like we need to do something about it. So our guests today are two college student activists from the Jewish Youth Climate Movement. Recently, these two activists were part of a delegation of student activists that attended COP27, the United Nations Climate Change Conference, and today we're going to hear from them about their experiences there and reflect on what they mean for our planet, most importantly, but also for the Jewish community in particular. By the way, we featured another member of the Jewish Youth Climate Movement, Madeline Canfield, last year around Passover, so it's becoming a bit of a tradition. Before we get into our conversation, we want to let you know that we have just opened registration for our next round of UnYeshiva 3-session mini courses. Just like last year, we're going to be running these courses during the 6 weeks between the end of Passover and the holiday of Shavuot. And you can register now at judaismunbound.com/classes. As always, the classes are taught by some of our favorite podcast guests, this time including a class on Jewish mysticism and ecology with Ariel Mays, a class on Jewitchcraft with Katsira Lesser, a class on sex and sexuality with Denise Handlarsky, and Lex is going to be co-teaching a class on interfaith families with Emma Newberry from the Breaking the Glass podcast. So we'll tell you about more of the classes in the weeks ahead, but you can check them out right now and register at judaismunbound.com/classes. So now let's get into our conversation with our guests from the Jewish Youth Climate Movement, which, by the way, they and we sometimes refer to as JYCM during this conversation. Our guests today are Sophie Raskin and Isaac Ostro. Sophie Raskin is a second-year student at the University of Vermont, where she studies music business technology and food systems. She was on the founding leadership and executive board of the Jewish Youth Climate Movement in 2019 and is now part of the JYCM Amitim College cohort. Our second guest, Isaac Ostro, is a first-year student at Wesleyan University. Right now, he's studying environmental studies and science in society. He is a climate activist with the Jewish Youth Climate Movement and also a JYCM college fellow. So let's get into this conversation about their experiences at the UN Climate Conference. Sophie Raskin, Isaac Ostro, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so this is a time of year where we start to be thinking, if anybody's thinking about Egypt, I feel like they're starting to think about getting out of Egypt with Passover coming up. But the two of you and others recently went into Egypt, and I'm wondering a little bit about that experience. Why was it that you went to Egypt? Who else was there? What was going on there?
So Isaac and I both got the opportunity to go to COP27, which was the United Nations Climate Conference, which was held in Egypt this year with the Jewish Youth Climate Movement and 10 other of our peers. Pretty much we got the opportunity to go listen to different speakers at the conference itself. And prior to going to Egypt itself, we went to Israel and learned a lot about sustainable agriculture, different energy sources, and other things along those lines.
Yeah, it was really cool to be there specifically as part of a youth delegation and get the opportunity to, you know, Egypt is it's very much a developing country. They don't have the infrastructure that a lot of countries in the global north have, which is part of the reason that it was chosen as the site for COP27, and COP stands for Conference of Parties, but right, really, it's just it's the United Nations Climate Conference. But it was very interesting. There were more delegates from fossil fuel companies there from any single country or any non-US country. I'm not exactly sure of the count, but I know that they were a disproportionate group of people at that table. And it was very interesting, right, to be Jewish in Egypt, to be young people in Egypt, to be climate activists in Egypt, and see, at least for me, what was a really different part of not only the world geographically, I'd never been to the Middle East, Israel, or Egypt before, but also geopolitically, and then also to have all of the major world leaders there. You know, we went through the Jewish Youth Climate Movement, which Sophie was a founding member, so I'm sure she can explain a little bit more about the origin. But the idea is that we're a national at the moment, actually international, we have some members in Canada, but we're an organization that tries to connect Jewish youth who have climate anxiety or are passionate about environmentalism or climate change, and try and channel all of our energy and power as youth to change what it means to be Jewish in terms of looking at the climate. Yeah, obviously that's a lofty goal, but you know, the movement is still young. I think we were founded in 2019.
So I was on the founding leadership board and executive board of JYCM back in the beginning of 2020. And JYCM has definitely shifted a lot these past couple of years. It used to be much more internal. And especially at the beginning of COVID, it was definitely an outlet for some sort of youth Jewish group to bring together kids across the country, definitely with a climate focus. But we have been building different kvutzot, which are our chapters, and we've been seeing them all across the country, and it's growing very rapidly. I'd say we have close to 60 chapters. Isaac, do you know the exact number?
I don't. Last I heard, which was months ago, it was 48. So 60 does not surprise me.
Yeah. A lot of these are rooted definitely in the Northeast, and it's definitely growing into more of a national movement other than an internal one.
Yeah, it's been really cool to see it be very non-denominational. So much of Jewish life is rather arbitrary, split up into various denominations. But the JYCM draws from people who are only, you know, ethnically or culturally Jewish and have very little practice. All the way, we have people who are modern Orthodox and daven regularly and, you know, are Shomer Shabbat. And so it's been exciting to see, as a movement of people trying to bring ourselves together, how do we coalesce around our differences? It's been very cool to watch it grow.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's something intuitive about that, right? Like, climate change doesn't target conservative Jews more than Reformed Jews, more than Orthodox Jews, more than Reconstructionist Jews. By the way, that's not to say that climate change doesn't disproportionately impact certain groups of society. It absolutely does. And I'd love to hear more from you about that. I'm not saying that because you don't know. I'm sure that's a lot of where your work is precisely focused. But I do want to back out a little to the why of this. I mean, you've both given us hints of this. But like, obviously, the why is almost obvious here, which is why we jump to some of the specifics of what your work looks like. The obvious thing being, like, our world is in peril. We are facing already serious climate devastation that is harming human beings. It's harming other species. We almost know that so deeply, I think, that we sometimes don't even name it, but we need to name it. So can you talk to us, like, why are there 60 chapters? I mean, that's a huge number. I don't think there are 60 chapters of any Jewish thing other than like Hillel and Chabad chapters on campuses. The fact that you have built a network of 60 chapters, or even if it's 48, whatever the number, that's incredible. And it's both awesome, right? But it's also terrifying, right? Because I think the reason for that is because people have a deep sense that this is super important to be a part of, and something we all need to be united to fight against. So like, why are the hundreds, or I don't know, thousands, however many individual people that are these 60 chapters, why are they feeling so compelled to be a part of this work generally? And also why, I guess, Jewishly?
I talked about this with my cantor at my synagogue as I got ready to graduate. And my cantor says, Isaac, I work with the Bar Mitzvah program. People having B'nai Mitzvot, you know, the Jewish rite of passage where you come to read the Torah. And traditionally, you know, the students will do a project where they try and give to a charity, commit some, you know, acts of tzedakah, of justice. And she told me that more and more kids come to her with climate anxiety. These are kids who are 11, 12, 13, just starting about this big religious process. And the forefront of their mind is climate anxiety. These kids were born, some of them, after the election of Barack Obama in 2008. And, you know, that Al Gore in 2000 is a, you know, it's, I was born after Al Gore lost the election. The scale of this problem in terms of time, we think, oh, you know, COP27, this is maybe something we've been talking about for 30 years. But there are millions of people for whom this is all they've ever known, is a world with natural disasters in the news and climate in the headlines. They are everywhere, to your point. They're Reform Jews and modern Orthodox Jews. They are Jews from Lexington, Massachusetts, and Jews from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I mean, there are, you know, there is climate anxiety everywhere. And as sad as it is, I think we can get hope from the JYCM. We intend to keep growing, and hopefully we can help people channel their climate anxiety into hope and into change.
Yeah, and I think what's so beautiful about this movement is we have such a wide variety of people, and we're all compelled through Judaism. It might be Jewish practice, Jewish culture, what we grew up learning from our families, that it is important to cherish the world that we live in and help fight this climate crisis. Why we have these large groups of people coming together is because we're just fed up with what is happening currently in the government with large industrial businesses. It is time for our voices to be heard. And that's why it was so important for groups of us to go to COP. And while what we saw at COP27 wasn't the most promising, I think that it did propel us forward in a very different direction than we were expecting. I think a lot of us were expecting to see these countries and businesses coming together and showing us all this hope, when in reality, a lot of what we saw was dread. I think it really taught us a lot about how it is going to be our job, and that's unfortunate, but to prepare ourselves and learn how to do that.
So can you give us a little bit more color about what you saw, like what happened at this conference, and specifically, like, what were you expecting to see that you didn't see, or vice versa? You say there was dread. How was that expressed? I think it would really help to understand this conference through your eyes and what you saw there.
The conference itself was set up into two different zones. There was the blue zone and there was the green zone. We had passes to the green zone, which was where a lot of youth activists were. And the blue zone was dedicated more to larger organizations and leaders of countries. And the first day that we walked into the green zone, a lot of the things that we, or I personally, would compare it to was looking like Coachella. Actually, yep. Ridiculous. We walk in and the first thing we see is this huge sign that says hashtag COP27. There are giant water features, plants that were definitely not indigenous to Egypt itself. And it looked like a giant photo op. There were light shows, and we were just all in shock, like jaw dropped. Actually, someone came up to me within the first 30 seconds that I was there, and he's like, hey, can you take a photo of me in front of the sign? I'm like, yeah, sure. And he said, yeah, I have to take a picture to send to my boss to prove that I've been here all week. And I was just like, oh, okay. This is the type of people that are here right now, kind of going here to meet a quota from their company or business or wherever to prove that they're doing something to help the climate. And it's not necessarily people that actually care about the future of the earth.
Yeah, I want to reiterate it. Totally, it felt like the Vegas Strip at night. There was music playing and big neon signs. I mean, the visuals
were...
What
have you been doing at the Vegas Strip first year in college?
Yeah, I went when I was like 9. And my mom had a conference there. But,
I love that.
But yeah, my memory... Right, you know, like water fountains. It was... Which, of course, Egypt is a desert. And the particular place in Egypt, Sharm el-Sheikh, is on the water, but very much a desert. The amount of money spent on water, you could hear diesel generators running wherever you were. It was discordant with our perception. And I think I would be surprised if it's not, you know, the closest integer to the percentage of the reporting that focused on the blue zone would have been 100%. Anybody who was anybody, if you had a press pass, if you're a leader of, whether it was Joe Biden who flew across the world for a day to come speak, or whether you were a smaller delegate from a smaller country or a corporation, you were in the blue zone. That is where the UN policy was being written. That was where the quote unquote real conference was happening. As Sophie had mentioned, there was a youth conference in the green zone, which sounds great. Oh, like here we can spotlight the youth, but it was really a 15-minute bus ride from the main conference. And it had two negative effects on the conference. The youth couldn't go and see where, like, the grown-ups were playing. We were basically at the kids' table. That was the analogy I used. And we can't go and hear what the adults are doing. We can't go and influence change, even though all of the youth delegates were, I'm sure, 16 to, you know, there were youth delegates there who were youth group coordinators and into their 30s and 40s and, you know, no longer holding, like, the youth status that a bunch of college students would have. But I think more detrimentally, the world leaders had no opportunity, unless they wanted to remove themselves from all of the important happenings, they had no opportunity to come and see youth. There were climate caucuses from all around the world. There were, Pan-African youth conferences and Jewish American conferences at JFK. When we landed and came home, we were waiting in a customs line with people who are from a Christian movement that sounded basically like the Christian youth climate movement. There were people from every background who'd come from all around the world and emitted a ton of carbon seeking an audience with powerful people. And we were told, oh, you go sit over here in the green zone. It was not only jarring to know that there was a difference, but it was also a little bit crushing to be like, oh, we belong here in the youth where it's not our time to even try and talk to world leaders.
So first off, that's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking both because I think that sucks to experience by the sound of it for all of you and for the others who traveled across the world to experience this. And it's just short-sighted and doesn't make any sense. Like y'all are the ones who will be on this planet the longest dealing with the most, I mean, we're, like I said, and we need to keep reiterating this because a lot of society still hasn't gotten it. Like, we're already experiencing consequences of climate change, but you will experience them in their most drastic form of people that are currently alive. And then, you know, for as long as we have human descendants, it may continue being harder and harder. But, like, that's heartbreaking, and it reflects some dynamics around condescension. On this show, we've spoken a lot about that in the Jewish world specifically. And I kind of want to go that direction to some extent, but I have two questions at the same time, and hopefully they're not too distant from each other. I think they're related. But one is for you to actually talk about why that's so wrong, like why the kids' table is actively harmful. Like, we've got an issue that for, you know, 60 chapters of people on college campuses is really drawing their passions out. Why wouldn't we, when the world is at stake, put those people in the center of the room as opposed to at the kids' table? So, like, I kind of want to hear more, like, what it would look like. It's the flip side. It's not what was wrong here. It's like, what would a better version of this conference look like? Or what would a better version of this conversation look like where we see, quote unquote, the youth, not as like, look at how young and passionate they are. Isn't that nice that they're showing up? And like, no, why is it that we actually need to see you? I don't have language for this. I was going to say, like, as elders. That's not the right terminology. Right. Like, we need to see you as real stakeholders, real players, to use language of B'nai Lapi, like players on the field, real people doing this work and not spectators watching or apprentices learning the ropes. Like, what would it look like, or maybe what does it look like in JYCM when you are actually at the center of those conversations, not the way it looked at COP27?
Yeah,
I think that a lot of us at that point in the conference, we were really questioning, why are we here? Not only why are we here as youths, but mostly, like, why are we here in the sense of, are we creating more harm by being here and by flying here than we are by what we're going to gain from this conference? And I think that what could have been wildly different is we are we have mobilized into a large group of Jewish youths in the US and a few outside of the US, and to utilize a group of people that are passionate, intelligent, educated about the climate. If we were given the opportunity to have some sort of youth conference or actually had a voice at the big kids table, obviously this is a fight that no one can do alone, and that we're not going to see all the governments of the world, I guess, mobilizing in a way that we wish. So we're going to have to utilize more grassroots organizations, and to go unnoticed just feels like a waste in a way.
That's really well said. I saw a tweet. I really like Twitter. I'm big on Twitter, as in I really like it. but I was at COP27. I was looking at Twitter because I was frustrated, as all of us were. And I was looking to see who else was here and talking about it. And I saw a tweet that was, of course, it was completely infeasible and ridiculous and unrealistic, but it was, COP27 should be entirely by, for, and about people who will be alive in 2060, which of course is a grim way of, it's a grim way of reducing the fact that elderly people in corporate positions or in, non-government organization positions and NGOs should not be able to dictate that for us. But then I really thought about it, and it was, of course, we can't say, you have to be this young to ride the COP27 roller coaster. I think it's a better approach to look at it as, are we listening to profit or people? Because it was very clear and many of the...
P-R-O-F-I-T. I wish we listened more to profits with a
exactly.
P-H-E-T.
Yes, profits with no P-H. Are we here trying to figure out a profitable solution to the climate crisis, or are we here trying to find a solution to the climate crisis? Because the reality is and has been for decades that we know exactly what we need to do. The steps we need to take are not a mystery to science. They are, there are logistical difficulties and the fact that they are not profitable. To your question about how does this, what should this look like? What would it look like if youth were given a voice? I don't think it's necessarily that we as youth have some different perspective. Lex, you were saying, you and many people, young and old, understand the issue of climate change and its severity. And it's not because we're young that we understand it. I think we have no other alternative. We have no short-term shareholder futures. We have no, I'm going to retire and die and this will be my grandkids' problem. We have no other option than to try and fight for this. And so it's, when I was there and I saw the data about the attendance of delegates from fossil fuel corporations, are you here because you're getting paid to be here? Or are you here because you have a legitimate concern for you and your kids and your grandkids? That's the divide, is people were there for political capital, social capital, or money capital, or people were there out of, I need to be here because I need to make a change. What I would like to see is a lot less talk about, is this going to be profitable? How are we going to afford this? The coffers available, theoretically, for things like war or for mega yachts exist. But there is so much passion for a profitable solution to climate change, and we're throwing out viable solutions, practical solutions, and available solutions.
It's reminding me of a story from, I think, the 1970s, maybe. There was a Jewish Federation conference, which is the conference of all the Jewish federations from all the cities. And there was a youth group, a group of youths that came there. I don't know if they were invited to, like you were, to sort of observe this wonderful conference, or they came on their own, but they ended up basically occupying it and demanding that the Jewish community change its priorities. Specifically, at that time, they were focused on Jewish education, and they got some results, and it was actually a very formative movement for a certain group of sort of a more radical voice within the Jewish community. So a very different topic, but it's interesting to imagine what would have happened if the youths had somehow occupied the Blue Zone, but realistically, he'd probably be arrested and deported. So the question is really like what to think about for the future, you know, and how to really imagine, okay, you've seen that the adult table, so to speak, is not getting anything done. So what does that mean in terms of next steps? But I also was thinking more in terms of connecting it to the Jewish element. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about your impulse to do this Jewishly. And I guess my question is, do you also have a similar point of view about the Jewish community as maybe you had about COP? Meaning, do you think that the Jewish community is doing a good job on climate? Or are you getting a kind of similar vibe from elements of the Jewish community?
The communities that I've grown up in have really compelled me to care a lot about the environment and the earth and just giving back to communities that might not have as many resources as I do or as we do. And so in that sense, my Jewish identity and what I view as Jewish culture, I guess, is very centered around giving back. And so I think those core values are there and present in many Jewish communities. It just kind of relies on what those individual ones are going to do. And that's what's so amazing about these chapters, these kibbutzot, is that it's not only in college campuses, it's in synagogues, it's in classrooms at Jewish day schools, it's at summer camps, like it's everywhere, because I think those core values are definitely there. It's just if you actually practice them and are doing something in a non-performative way, which I think is a lot of what we learned about this trip, is that performative activism is something, while we've always known this, it's very aggravating. And I think that we really solidified the fact that we don't want to be performative. We want to actually see the progress that we're making, educate people, and in some way make a substantial impact. And I think that right now, after this trip, we're still brainstorming and seeing what we can do to fulfill that goal.
Yeah, I think we need, at some level, a systems change. And the Jewish community is, of course, you know, certainly in America, is not nearly as insular or as isolated from the broader world as we once were. One of the JYCM's biggest headline-grabbing moments is we helped to coordinate a protest in New York City calling on Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, who is also a member of the tribe. He's Jewish, calling on him to divest from fossil fuel companies. And BlackRock has a completely incomprehensible amount of money. It's hundreds of billions of dollars. It's, nobody can understand numbers that big. I say it and I don't understand the weight of it. Hundreds of billions of dollars invested in BlackRock. And we said, evidently, he's not listening to the science, because the science is, there's no gray area in the science about whether or not that's a good idea. But there's, you know, Judaism is about the gray areas. It's about wrestling with God. It's about, you know, the uncertainty and spirited debate. And so I think that was part of the Jewish approach. Like, we need to find systems change. Our systems are broken, whether that's the United Nations and their systemic, you know, kids table, or whether that's the delegates there who, after 2 weeks of flying private jets to COP27, came away with a timetable that they had to agree to start paying people hurt by climate change by the next COP. Sounds like it could have been an email to me. Like, that was the big takeaway. Like, really, this was a whole bunch of carbon emissions and a positive spotlight on an Egyptian government that is doing some questionable things in greenwashing and in many other facets of their rule. But my conclusion was, we need systems change. So why would I look to the Jewish community for that? This reason for me personally is a little bit selfish, and it's that I and my peers can have a louder voice in the Jewish community than we can writ large in the secular community. You know, I was a member of the second leadership board. I was the first time they expanded. That was when I joined the JYCM. I saw this as a way for me to channel my energy and activism into a place where I could help to set a new trend for, although a smaller group of people, of course, Jews are a global minority, pretty much anywhere we are a minority, but we can be a loud minority and a vocal minority. And I saw the opportunity to step in and try and make change in a way that I saw that I thought would fit me, as opposed to, you know, our comrades in the Sunrise Movement or Extinction Rebellion who do and have done incredible work. But I couldn't come and be a leader there. I participated in school, but that was a much smaller scale than I know is accessible to me through the JYCM. And then finally, it is Jewish values. My Jewish education has very much taught me to speak truth to power and to wrestle with people who tell you no when you know they're wrong, and to question everything. And I chased climate change up the ladder and found myself at the UN, and I still wasn't happy because that further, you know, my Jewish values and the way that they taught me to pursue things further solidified my understanding that we need a systems change. We cannot, you know, make the progress that we need with the systems that we have, because they have interests, you know, chiefly profit off of fossil fuels that are going to potentially prohibit me and my children from having a habitable planet.
Yeah. I really want to sit in some of these pieces that both of you have brought up. First off, flashing all the way back to when one of you mentioned B mitzvahs, you know, 11, 12, and 13 year olds who are at a very young age already noticing the need that our planet has and sculpting their own, you know, coming of age ceremonies around doing what they can to serve the combating of climate change. My Torah portion as a 13 year old was Noah. It was Noah's Ark. It was a global catastrophe wiping out all of human inhabitation except for one family. That's what my Torah portion was. I did not talk about climate change. I think if I had that same Torah portion this year and was 13, I probably would have. And I'm not saying I would have, like, look at how smart I would have been. That's just like, it's such a clear-cut connection to make. And the other piece that comes up from that is we forget with Noah's Ark story, because it's in the Torah, that it's not a story about Jews. Nobody in the Noah's Ark moment is a Jew. It's pre-Jews. Abraham and Sarah come 10 generations later. So there is a way in which we're sort of, I want to sort of dwell in this question of quote-unquote as a Jew activism and quote-unquote as a human being activism. I think both of those are really important. What you said, Isaac, let's say there's 15 million Jews globally, like somewhere in that range. That's actually a pretty great size for one person to still matter, but like still have a grand impact. It's like a good scale of people where, you know, you can have and within the US there's, you know, 6-7 million Jews, something like that. It's small enough that you can have a measurable impact. You can, as the two of you did, take some steps and be channeled into a movement that's going to the UN. Like that's there's a way in which a lot of the activism I don't do it because it's more important for me to speak out, you know, quote unquote, as a Jew. The levers of change that exist in this world are sometimes localized. I can and should focus on affecting, you know, the micro communities I'm a part of. And the Jewish community, it's not micro, it's one scale up. But like, that's actually, I think, an argument for why, in general, we should engage with Jewishness, with Jewish life. Because, I mean, let's say you live in a city with a few hundred thousand people. If there's a few thousand Jews, all of a sudden, oh, I can myself play a role in shifting how this community of a few thousand people acts in the world. And I think that it's the farthest thing from selfishness. So if somebody in your movement from Sunrise or from Extinction Rebellion were to disagree with you, they would bring the counter take, which is right now more than ever, we need to be doing this work more as human beings than as Jews or as Christians or as Muslims or as Buddhists or as whatever nationalities, nationalisms we are. We have to do it as humans because we're failing to see that we're all targeted collectively by something shared. How would you respond to folks who strategically differ and think, you know what, we shouldn't be anchoring our activism into our Jewishness or any other identity piece of who we are? I'm not saying they're right. I'm just curious how you...
No, I mean, we've had this conversation in the JYCM more than once. My stance on it, we don't, I think, have an official take on this as a movement, but my take has always been, you know, right, Jewish youth climate movement. How does the Jewish fit in? I think I would like to be a part of the Jews at the climate movement, the Jews doing climate work. there has been some discussion. Do we want to participate in secular movements? Yeah, I can understand why people may want to just carve out a space to be Jewish activists. And also I can understand, of course, as you just explained, like, right, this is a, you know, the climate doesn't care, you know, what God you worship, if you worship God at all. You know, there is absolutely a space for humanism as opposed to any identity division. And I think that so far in the JYCM, we've been able to try and find a balance, you know, whether that's on college campuses, working with Sunrise groups and, you know, whatever your Jewish community center is, whether that's a Hillel Chabad or something not affiliated, you know, work with them. Go, if you wear a kippah or a tallit, go and be visibly Jewish and leading a climate protest. You know, it doesn't have to include a Jewish prayer or a call to worship or anything other than I am visibly Jewish here doing climate work. Obviously, if you're visibly Jewish, or, you know, we have Jewish Youth Climate Movement merch that you can buy at jewishyouthclimatemovement.org if you are so interested.
Very nice product placement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a cheap plug, but they're there. And if you are interested and you want to identify yourself as Jewish and you're doing climate work, I think that has been my approach. But if you're protesting somewhere where you feel comfortable, my experience is to be visibly and vocally Jewish, but not necessarily to try and make your climate protest Jewish.
The climate crisis obviously doesn't just affect the Jewish community. And I think that while a lot of the things we as a movement have done is through synagogues or through Hillel, that if we are doing climate activist work, it is something that is an attempt to help the greater community and not just internally, because as you said, this isn't something that we can do alone. This is something we have to do all together. And I think that taking the space that we have as Jewish people, but always advocating for others. And I think that's what's important about having a space for Jews specifically, is so that we can be a part of the conversation.
I'm curious whether it's as youth or as particularly Jewish youth, you have a take, whether that's, again, as individuals or as a movement, about what it is that really ought to be done. And I'm also thinking specifically about how that relates to the Jewish side, because I feel like sometimes when I've spoken with folks that are very focused on climate, they tend to fall into one of two categories. Some are like very hyper-local. It's like, right, we should be focused on recycling and having a low personal carbon impact, et cetera. And others are focused very much on the big picture. We should be, you know, like protesting in front of BlackRock, and we should be fighting for the fossil fuel companies and everything. And part of what I've been wondering Jewishly is whether actually part of the genius of Judaism is the recognition that all of those are tied together. And the middle category there becomes, and this is part of my question, what about the Jewish community itself as a potential actor in the climate crisis that needs to change the way it's acting? In part, even though you might say, well, that's just one small community, it's not really going to change the climate, but maybe if the Jewish community became a model for responsible climate activity, even at a level of just 15 million people, it would somehow be more powerful as an actor on the bigger stage. And I kind of feel like, and I'm wondering what you think, that it feels to me that the Jewish community often talks a good game about climate, but still then uses a lot of single-use plates and stuff at Kiddush after synagogue, right? And does all kinds of things, you know, to keep Passover. A lot of people are putting aluminum foil all over their kitchen. And those are little things, but I feel like part of what Judaism has done, as I've understood it over the millennia, is to say there's like no such thing as a little thing, and that these little things cultivate habits and states of mind. And that's part of, I guess, what I'm asking, whether maybe what we really need is an integration of climate care into the larger picture of how Judaism operates. And are we really seeing that happening, or are we really just seeing a lot of people give some nice sermons about Tikkun Olam?
That's right. That's a very pertinent question. I know in my experience, so for a little bit of background, The JYCM's parent organization is Hazon.
Since recording this episode a few months ago, Hazon has renamed itself Adama. You can learn more at adama.org. What follows is still true, but now the organization is called Adama.
Which is the largest faith-based environmental nonprofit. And they have had, since probably before some of our leadership board members were born, the Hazon Seal of Sustainability for a Jewish institution. And that includes divesting whether that's a synagogue or a school's endowment from fossil fuels and trying to procure sustainable electricity, whether that's solar panels or paying a little bit more to the grid. And now it is including things like compost. And so it is absolutely those smaller scale actions. But what I remind myself or my parents or my community is that you're right. We need to tackle both individual and household and community emissions, but also corporate emissions. We know there's data that suggests that 71% of global fossil fuel emissions are the result of the 100 most carbon emitting companies. So if we then take what must be true, then 29% of carbon emissions are caused by everything that isn't those 100 most carbon emitting companies. It would be incredible if we could get a 30% reduction in carbon emissions. That is absolutely something that we should not say isn't desirable, because of course it is. However, it's not enough. And a 71% is much more likely to trigger enough reduction in carbon emissions to make that happen. So we know we need to tackle the systemic issue and the biggest, the most problematic emitters. And we also, along the way, should reduce our individual impact on the climate. Both are true. However, if I'm going to pick one in my activism, can I let myself pick? I need to help my synagogue and synagogues around the country. I, of course, want to help them use compostable plates and solar energy if available and reduce their carbon footprint. But I could have a bigger impact if they can contribute to systemic divestment, not only of their synagogue's endowment, but of course, Jewish people hold positions in all of secular life, whether they are on the board of trustees for schools or corporations or nonprofits, or if they have any sway over any other decision. Of course, it's going to vary person to person, but getting a cultural shift that can generate a systems change, I have to focus on that, because otherwise there's that lingering, if every person on earth got their individual carbon footprint down to next to nothing, we would still have the giant, the monster of corporate carbon emissions.
So I'm also thinking about what this might look like on a local level for smaller Jewish institutions. Isaac, I love what you just said about, it's not that you don't focus on your local Jewish institutions, it's that you try to get them doing solidarity work, you know, try to get your synagogue outside in the streets of BlackRock, right? Like it's they can be doing that work. It's not just about the plates they use, right? It's that we're not used to some local Jewish institutions taking that kind of role. We think of them as just like, oh, community gathering organizations and religious practicing organizations, whatever we might call it. Like, the time for being just that and leaving, quote unquote, the politics or the social justice or whatever to a certain small minority of Jewish institutions that are like squarely devoted to that, I think that time is gone, or at least it needs to be gone.
Yep.
And so I'm finding myself returning to something I said before about how we need to recognize, like, climate change is here and it's affecting our world, but it's actually it is impacting certain kinds of people more than others.
Absolutely.
And that happens along all the same axes that we're used to in society. I mean, people who have access to less money, they already, but especially as we move forward, like as areas become less inhabitable in the face of climate change, the people who are going to be forced to live there are going to be the people with the least resources.
Yep.
And then that's already happening. The places where air quality is the worst are almost always the places that are inhabited by poor people, by Black and brown people. Like this all squares with the analysis we need to be doing, not just of like climate as an issue, but so many other issues that are in fact impacting our society. And so because the Jewish population is itself multiracial and is itself not homogeneous, I do think that there is work we could be doing within the Jewish community to focus on. There actually are areas that Jews live that are more and less affected already by what we call natural disasters, but are actually the result of human action in the last, you know, little while that is bringing on climate change. Like, we can, in fact, we can be doing like intra-Jewish work in a sense, right? We can be serving Jews that live in certain areas that are more likely to have fires or more likely to be dealing with real like catastrophic consequences of climate change. And also, as we do that, we're not just helping the Jews who live there, right? Like, we're helping others too. Who are the Jews actually that are most facing the consequences of climate change already? And how would we, in the same way that a Jewish federation, you know, allocates money to Jews who are poor, and in the same way that different organizations try to empower Jews who are marginalized, how do we do that with respect to climate? Spoiler alert, a lot of it's actually the same work. But how do we frame it in that way? And how would we then be sort of practicing strategies that are more generalizable, where we can be a model, like Dan was saying, beyond just the Jewish, where we can be doing something that then other communities actually follow?
Yeah, we have a presentation on racial inequity and environmental justice. And it's, you know, right, we call it environmental racism. And it's exactly what you were talking about. We were very excited going into COP27. The big theme, I think it was loss and damages. And the idea is that there are countries, a lot of them in Oceania and Africa and Southeast Asia, the island nations in the South Pacific are the easiest to understand. They may literally be underwater and already are flooding and losing dangerous percentages of their habitable land as a direct result of carbon emissions that they did not cause. And the idea is that the Western world, the global North, the colonizers and the industrial powers, you know, nations like the United States and Western Europe, bear the brunt of the responsibility at this moment for carbon emissions and climate crisis historically, and have the wealth and resources to pay for the damage that they're causing. And so that is an issue that we can try and tackle on a scale as great as the UN, or as small as this is our Jewish community. There are people who may not be able to afford whatever steps it is to take to decarbonize or to be safe from carbon emissions. But I mean, I have a close friend on the leadership board, Asher, who's from South Florida. He is active in secular movements. He's active in his school government and local government and in the JYCM, because he literally is facing like the loss of his home as a concrete reality. I live in inland and in Massachusetts, which, though it's not mountainous, I have a couple hundred feet of elevation, and sea level rise is not going to be an imminent threat to me or my family. And in that sense, I'm, of course, privileged. But the reality is that there are, of course, people who are, you know, who don't have the money to move out, or if they need to evacuate to stay in hotels. We saw that in Texas and the South this year. Like, there were people staying at home because they couldn't get a hotel. That was their only financial option. We are already seeing race, class, gender as primary dividers of who is and isn't safe from the climate crisis, even in a country like the United States that is relatively less damaged than a lot of places in the global South.
At the beginning of my time in JYCM, a lot of our discussions were centered around environmental racism and how it also has been affecting places like Cancer Alley, which was an area which was predominantly a Black community that was affected so drastically that most of the people that lived in this area ended up getting cancer or other terminal illnesses as well, because of the air quality. And I think that this is something that is going to continue to be a large part of the discussion in and out of JYCM, because like, even as though there is not as many Jewish communities in a lot of these spaces, there are people that are geographically affected greatly in and out of JYCM and in and out of our Jewish community.
When you were talking earlier about how many chapters there were of the Jewish Youth Climate Movement, I was starting to think about when my dad was a youth, and there were all these Zionist youth movements. And it sort of seemed like that was this project that got people excited. And maybe by analogy, today, the area of great passion among Jewish young people is saving the planet. And so it would be natural for the youth movements that would work, right? Because there are all these people in the Jewish community, like, why aren't people joining the conservative movement's youth movement or the reform movement's youth movement or all the or the Zionist youth movement? They're all shrinking. And so apparently the youths aren't so interested in Jewish youth movements anymore. And my sense is that, no, that's not right. The youths are interested in Jewish youth movements if they're relevant, if they give them a sense that to be Jewish is actually something that gives me the capability of doing what I'm trying to do with my life. And so I'm just wondering if you can think a little bit together with us about the climate movement and the Jewish world, whether separately or together. What would it look like for you to imagine a Jewish youth movement, a Jewish youth movement focused on climate that would truly be popular, meaningful, exciting? And maybe this is just really a question of what are your long-term plans for your youth movement?
I think that something we're going to start seeing more of is the intersection of JYCM within different youth organizations. We actually had a retreat in February that was joint between any JYCM member and any USY member. And I think that that's something we're going to start seeing more and more of. But I completely agree. Yeah, it's, I feel like, especially since COVID, motivating people to go, or youths to go to these different youth organizations is definitely trickier. For people to feel passionate about something is going to be a way to mobilize in Jewish youth group or in movement as JYCM. And so I think that a lot of it is going to kind of conjoin in some way.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dan, that there needs to be a sense of excitement and mobilization with regard to this movement. There's something about the climate crisis and Tikkun Olam and looking at climate change from a Jewish background that can bring people together from not only, as we've discussed, denominational backgrounds, but also left-wing, right-wing politics, or Zionist or non-Zionist American Jews, or people from any and all, you know, gender, race, any background, can agree that we need the earth to live on. And so that's where I think there's hope. We have all of those different identities represented within our movement. And as we grow, I'm sure we're only going to get more diversity of people and identity and perspective. But I think what's amazing about the JYCM experience is certainly on our leadership board retreats. It's been, I don't want to say camp-like necessarily, because there's very much the air of we're here to do work. But also there were dozens of young Jewish teenagers coming together to do something that we are all passionate and proud of and going to have fun doing. And so there is absolutely a benefit to having our activism be appealing. There's a million different ways for us to bring people into the fold. And at the end of the day, that is our goal, is to make this a Jewish reality. And by this, I mean, make climate activism a Jewish reality.
I have a closing question that brings us back to the kids' table piece from early on. I really want to close there. You can tie it to climate specifically, but I kind of want to focus it a little on Jewish life, because I think it's a massive problem on climate change, but also on so many other issues. People are surprised when I tell them that our metrics for Judaism Unbound, when we look at like who listens to us, we don't have certain kinds of deep data, but it appears that 18 to 24 year olds, that bracket, are substantially overrepresented in our listenership. That's surprising to people, because I think there's still this narrative that like, oh, the youth, quote unquote, by and large, they're not that into Jewish stuff. Why would they be listening to a Jewish podcast whose primary audience is like adults of all ages? Like they're, you know, they're on TikTok or whatever. Like there's this narrative. I mean, look, TikTok, I'm not here to slam TikTok. Also be on TikTok. Use TikTok for climate activism. Awesome. But like all that's to say, I believe we have a massive problem with how Jewish communal life structures its relationship to quote unquote young people. What would you call on our Jewish community to shift about their relationship? Sorry, even as the way I'm saying it, I'm implying that, quote unquote, the Jewish community is a set of people who are not youths, and they are doing a bad or good job of including youths. I want to correct myself on that. You are the Jewish community, quote unquote. You are not external to it such that you could be welcomed in by them. So how could you, as leaders of the Jewish community, not leaders of tomorrow or whatever, how would you call on others in the Jewish population to more equally spread power among all age constituents who are around, especially, but not only, on the issue of climate change?
Yeah, Lex, thank you. I mean, you're right. We are, to an extent, the Jewish community on social media or on TikTok. I'm going to plug the JYCM TikTok at Jewish Youth Climate Movement.
Professional plugger here. I love it.
But right, we are the Jewish community on TikTok. You know, I'm sure there are very few non-young people who are on any Jewish TikToks regularly. And so my call to the other young people in the Jewish community is, you can be loud and annoying. You can send a lot of emails and you can continue to, we have a phrase in JYCM that we like, it's called loving agitation. Continue to lovingly agitate your clergy, in any Jewish community, if you go to Jewish day school, your teachers, your classmates, if you attend services, even just at the high holidays, say hello to the rabbi or to the youth group members, keep sending those emails and continue to lovingly agitate them, because even if they get annoyed at your emails asking for an audience with the finance committee to talk about divesting from fossil fuels, we have resources like that also available if you're interested in becoming a kutza. But this whole thing is not a plug. I'm going to get back on track. Practice loving agitation, because the alternative is an unsustainable future. You know, the alternative is not something that we can afford to entertain. Not only for the Jewish Youth Climate Movement, but for all climate activists and Jewish activists, I wish we had more time. I wish it were 1992 and 30 years ago. And we're talking about, you know, the UN maybe hosting the first climate action conference. I wish we had that kind of time to slowly build and grow. But the science is telling us, like, we barely have a decade. And so I hate to sound, you know, accelerationist or too radical, but if we are not shouting from the rooftops, by the time the compromise that will need to happen in order to get anything done happens, we'll be too far from a solution. So don't negotiate with yourself. You know what we need for a sustainable future, and you know what maybe a little bit more than we need for a sustainable future. Lovingly agitate your people from further from where we need to be, so that by the time you compromise with the finance committee or your local town's rules about where you can and can't put solar panels, or whether or not you can get the day off of school or miss enough class to go protest at BlackRock, yell from the rooftops that we need change. And by the time people compromise with you, we may actually get the change we need in the time frame that we require.
I think a lot of times were seen or perceived as like the token youth. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us, given the time that we've grown up, we've had to grow up a lot faster. And I think that that can be very overwhelming for a lot of people and can honestly deter certain people from speaking up as loud as others, because it feels like just this constant pressure that is put on us that we have to be the ones to fix this. And that, sorry, we screwed this up for you guys. Maybe figure it out in a couple of years, but we're going to just pretend like we care still and kind of promote your voices, but kind of not at the same time, as we can see what happened at COP27, you know, kind of making a space for us. And I think that it's up to us to not occupy this quote unquote space that they've made for us, but occupying the space that they're pushing us away from, because that is the space that we should be occupying. And if we're going to be forced to grow up faster, and if we're going to be forced to have to take on all these giant roles that are going to be so important to our future in the next couple of years, we need to not be seen as these token youths anymore and be seen as primary voices that should be at that table.
Wow. Thank you both, Isaac Ostro and Sophie Raskin, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thanks so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. Before we tell you all the ways that you can be in touch with us, Judaism Unbound, we're going to encourage you to definitely learn more about JYCM, the Jewish Youth Climate Movement. You can learn more about their work by heading to adamah.org/JYCM. That's adamah.org/JYCM. And you can also head to our show notes where we have some links to amazing work that they've done and their website and all sorts of good stuff. But now for being in touch with us, there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram pages. All of our handles are at Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com, where you can find show notes for this episode, where you can check out our courses in the On Yeshiva that are going to be offered in just a couple weeks. And of course, you can always email us via dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you're able to send our way. And you can do that on either a monthly recurring basis or just as a one-time gift via judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.